The Marine Interest Group of San Luis Obispo County. This is now a group that is in its fourth year of activity. It started in January of 2003 with three main purposes, those being to promote understanding of the marine resources off the coast of San Luis Obispo County, secondly, to openly examine potential ways to sustain and enhance them, and third, to recommend desirable courses of action or no action as appropriate on different topics, in order to support those resources and their sustainable use. So that's the basic purpose. This is an informal group. It's a working group. This is not a legislative body, so we don't have public hearings and, you know, all that sort of thing. We do invite people from the public to make comment along the way on particular topics as they come up. So we want you to be involved in that way. If you'd like more information about the group, there's some information at the website that you can go to and see some updates and things that are occurring, and past meetings. Over the course of this group, there have been more than two dozen meetings on various topics with experts from around the country, and really helping to understand the resources here and how to work with them more effectively. So we're delighted that you're here this evening and that you're listening, and welcome your participation. What we're going to do is follow the agenda on the salmon sheet. So there's some extras for the members of the audience. If you don't have one, they're over on the chairs in the back. All the members have them here. What I'd like to do is, early on in the development of the Marine Interest Group, people worked to establish what they were hoping for about the future of these resources. And the green sheet here captures what those hopes are. I thought since it's been a while since we met, actually it was April of last year that we met, I thought it'd be helpful when we go around and people introduce themselves to just have everyone in turn read one of these hopes out to just kind of recenter the group about what we're about here and get refocused on the purpose of this group and let the audience know what you're hoping to accomplish. So, Henry Pontarelli, if you might start, your name, what organization you're associated with, read the first hope off the list here, and if you have a quick update on something that you need to bring to the attention of the group, this is a time for like one-minute announcements.
Great. Henry Pontarelli, Moral Coast Audubon Society. One of our hopes is to establish a good baseline data to determine necessary and desirable action. I don't have anything this
okay.
evening. I know we got a lot to cover.
Dave.
I am Dave Sears. Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. One of our objectives was to learn the status of the resources and then determine what needs help. Bring the best fisheries and scientific resources to the task and provide accurate information to policymakers. That, to date, is still probably our strongest output that has been accomplished by this big group. And I don't have anything else to add except to hand it on to Pam.
Thank you, Dave. My name is Pam Hetherington, and I'm representing the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo, ECOSLO. One of the things that we're going to strive to do is enhance public awareness and understanding of the resources with accurate information and provide educational outreach programs.
I'm Andrew Christie. I'm with the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, and we are seeking to ensure a clean ocean to sustain the fisheries for future generations and to serve food, sport, and ecosystem health interests. Good water quality is like a good blood supply. It's the cornerstone of marine resources.
I'm Dan Berman. I'm the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, and one of the goals of the MIG is to preserve sensitive areas and biological resources, to protect habitat, sustain diversity, and serve the public interest. And as far as an update from the estuary program, we've got lots of projects going on. I'd encourage folks to check out our website, which is mbnep.org. And we recently published Estuary Tidings, a report on the health of the estuary, which you can download there or you can request from us. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. My name is Jeremiah O'Brien, representing the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization. And one of our goals is to increase the quantity and quality of marine resources consistent with what the habitat can sustain in a balanced way. And don't have too much more to add.
PJ Webb, I'm with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council, and my point on the preservation of the fishing community hope is to preserve a lifestyle and culture around sustainable fisheries that reflects that the ocean is a good, healthy place to be and can provide a good sport and quality family experience. Is this an appropriate time for announcements like update information from the Sanctuary Advisory Council?
Yeah, we actually have an update specifically from you listed under other updates. We've allotted about 5 minutes later on for that. If that works for you. Okay, good.
Marla Morrissey, Conservation Chair for the Marine Interest Group. And we are aiming to provide local access to seafood and promote local providers. I do have a quick update that's not agenda, and it's in regards to the jurisdictional map that the Marine Interest Group okayed. Being worked on, and that Shirley Bianchi funded with the supervisor discretionary funds. I'll pass out a couple copies of this. And it you guys have seen this before, but it actually the first phase is finished, and it's now you can go to steelheadrecovery.org/dig. And we'll be putting it on the NEP website. Each of the logos that you see on this, it's not interactive, but if you press the logo, you go to that agency. So basically it shows the elected representatives, the federal representatives and agencies, state reps and agencies, and fishing and conservation groups. So this was pretty exciting to have completed. More exciting is that phase two is already underway, in which each of the agencies will be GIS and be able to be a layer with the Fish and Game Department and other agencies, and we'll be working on a directory for each of the agencies that will be available as well. It'll probably take another year, but good work from the MIG. Thank you.
I'm Dave Reimel, sport fishing captain. I represent sport fishing. We open up April 1st for salmon fishing and March 1st, May 1st for rock fishing. So we'll be back on the water then. Manage marine resources to be sustainable with public access and use, both consumptive and non-consumptive, while protecting from damaging uses.
I'm Carolyn Moffitt. I'm chairman of the Harbor Commissioner at Port San Luis Harbor District. Thank you, Dave, for the update on the opening seasons. I might add that the rock fishing will be open after having been closed for 8 months. And I hope that the public will take the opportunity to participate in this, because our lessees who provide that opportunity are very much looking forward to serving them. I'd like to add also that the Port San Luis Harbor Master Plan is going before the Coastal Commission in April. And this will be the plan of operations and action for the Harbor District for the next approximately 20 years. I'd like to say that the management of the resources, we intend to streamline and enhance the effectiveness of management with better coordination and communication among regulatory agencies.
Mel?
My name is Mel DeLamont. I'm the president of the Central Coast Fisheries Conservation Coalition. We have over 1,000 members, most of them living here on the Central Coast. One of our purposes is to promote and preserve recreational fishing along the Central Coast. We're interested in preserving this natural resource so that future generations will always be able to have recreational fishing. Bob Hather, who's a member of our board of directors, has been here frequently. It's likely that I will be appearing more frequently now than he will.
Okay. Welcome. John Rowley.
John Rowley with Sport Fishing and Whale Watching here in Morro Bay. And one of the goals is to openly examine potential ways to sustain and enhance the resources.
Okay. Thank you. Dean.
I'm Dean Wendt. I'm the research representative on the committee. I'm a faculty member at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department at the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences. I didn't see where you left off.
I think the second to the last bullet point under the hoax is the last one to be mentioned.
We're here to recommend desirable courses of action or no action as appropriate to support the resources and their sustainable use, and also to, is that correct?
Yeah, and I think the one that might have been stepped over was exercise good stewardship in order to ensure the widest compatibility and use of the resources.
Okay. Excellent, that too.
All right. Okay, so next up on the agenda, and we want to introduce Janice Peters, who's the mayor of Morro Bay. And
I'm here as Jim Wood's alternate tonight.
Welcome, glad you're here.
Thank you.
And we appreciate the use of the facilities.
Of course.
So next item on the agenda is letters and other communications. I've received two items. One is a letter that was sent via the Postal Service from the Sierra Club from June 27th, 2005, in which the Sierra Club puts forward a resolution in support of extension of the Marine National Marine Sanctuary from Monterey Bay. And I'll just pass this along so that everyone can have an opportunity to see that. And the other communication I received is from the World Wildlife Fund, one of the original funders of the Marine Interest Group. And they're announcing a competition for fishermen to come up with ideas for reducing bycatch. And the award for coming up with the best gear concept is $25,000. And there's an example, I guess, in the back, if people want to pick it up, of someone, a fisherman who won this last year and got $25,000 for figuring out how to structure his gear in a way that could be effective for that purpose. So invite people to take a look at that if they'd like to learn more about that opportunity and have a chance to make some money if they would. So those are the two communications that I've received on your behalf. Now we want to move into the heart of the program, which is to review the two topics that this group picked last year for discussion at this meeting. One is the collaborative research. The other is what's happening with the ecosystem-based management program. And Dean Wendt is at the center of both of those activities. And as you heard from the members describing their hopes for this group, it really speaks to two of the core things that we're seeking to accomplish here. One, better understand the resources, and two, figure out how to work and coordinate the agencies and stakeholder groups that are involved and have an interest in those to be more effective in the management of them. So, Dean, collaborative research.
Great. Thanks, Don. Tonight we're going to be hearing from two of the groups that have been doing the collaborative research. We're going to be hearing about the pelagic bird survey in Morro Bay, which has been underway for a year now, and we have a year's worth of data to compare to work that was done by Fish and Game in the mid-70s to 1980. And so we're going to hear where we are with that project. And we're also going to be receiving a presentation from the group that is working on the Cabazon live fish fishery, the trap fishery. Obviously, we have two more years of funding that we just received to continue the collaborative work that we've been doing with the bird survey and the commercial fishermen collaboration, and also to continue our assessment of the near shore fish assemblage working with the commercial passenger fishing vessels. And I just wanted to make a final comment about that study, which we heard about before during the last meeting that we had. And there have been some recent articles in the paper that people have shown some interest in. And I just wanted to update you on the process of that and where we are with the data set and what's happening with the manuscript. We submitted the an abstract to CalCoffee, which is, and actually I can show you here. This is one single slide that I have here. It was a conference. It's a yearly conference by this group, California Cooperative Oceanic Fisheries Investigation, which is a collaboration between NOAA Fisheries, Fish and Game, and Scripps Institute of Oceanography. And it's been around for about 50 years, this collaboration. And they have an annual conference. And we submitted an abstract and were selected to present the data that we've collected for this area in December. And John Stevens gave that presentation, and you can see here, this is from the program. My thing isn't working, but that's okay. Anyway, so those data were presented here, and it was a competitive process. That is, they have to accept your application, your abstract, and ask you to present. And then after you do that, you submit a manuscript, where the manuscript goes through peer review. And this is a very important process, the peer review process. And the data that we've presented before has not been peer reviewed. And so until it is peer reviewed, it's not considered entirely legitimate. That is, you can talk about it and make conclusions from it, but until it's been through peer review, it's not considered scientifically valid, if you will. And so accepted to be presented, and he thought that was the peer review process. And so I clarified that with him, and he was apologetic and, you know, said that he made an honest mistake and genuinely felt bad about that. And so I just wanted to make that comment that it is currently in peer review, and once it's gone through peer review, the trends and conclusions associated with the manuscript and what you've seen presented will have scientific validity that I think a lot of people are hoping for. But we don't know what's going to happen in that process. Papers get rejected, or they get revised, and conclusions get revised. And so that's something that's very important to keep in mind, and I think something that we all have to keep in mind for a very important reason, that this is an interesting group in that we have scientists that are at the table that are sharing data with the public long before it normally happens. Usually, we don't put it out until it's been through peer review and people have seen it. We, as a group, sort of have a responsibility to recognize that the scientists are coming forward with information that hasn't been peer reviewed, and we just have to keep that in mind when we talk about it, that what we're saying is really preliminary until it's been through that rigorous process. But we don't want to stop the sharing process, but we all have to keep that in mind.
Jeremiah, you got a question?
Is there any timeline on the process?
It's supposed to, like I said, in a couple months. It really depends. You submit an article for peer review, and it depends on how expeditious the reviewers are. And there are people at other institutions that have expertise in these areas, and sometimes they're really busy and they don't get back to the editor for a couple of months. So it all depends. It's usually a few months is the turnaround time. So, you know, the end of March, something like that, but you never know how long it's going to take.
I might take another question here, but then in the interest of all the other things, if you've got more questions, ask Dean at a break or something, but go ahead, Pam.
Dean, has that been corrected in the Tribune as far as Bob Hather's saying that it was peer reviewed?
I didn't read the letters to the editor this morning, but I don't think it has been.
Is there a move to do that? I think that might be something that the MIG would like to address. I know I would.
I think that would be perfectly fine. Bob Hather may do that himself. I think that would be...
Somebody had to make comment about Jim Webb's letter because there was a lot of errors in it. So that's why I did it, and I know probably that's why Bob did it. Bob and I didn't even know we were writing letters. The trip put him in the same day. But, he can retract it if he wants, but I said nothing about peer review. Consequently,
I'm not asking for retraction. No. I know. I'm only asking for a correction.
And I said nothing about peer review, so I've got nothing to correct. I basically said the same thing without peer review.
And, I would just comment that, I don't think anyone's asking for any kind of retraction. I think that what we're asking is that all of us and that the public need to recognize that the weight behind what you have said and what we have said is not that great until it's been peer reviewed. That's the only point. And it's a very important point from a scientific perspective. And so you will always hear me be very tentative about conclusions until something's been peer reviewed. It's just the way that I operate as, in science. And so it's an important distinction.
Okay. So would you like to move on to the first topic here, the pelagic bird survey?
I would.
Okay.
I would like to move on to that.
One of the things that I've been requested of by the members is that we really keep to the time allocation. So I've adopted a high-tech device here. When we reach the end of the allotted time, I will hit the gong, and that will be the signal that we'll need to move on. Not to eliminate further discussion, but just to invite people to have that discussion be after the meeting or by email or by phone. This is very robust information, and I'm sure you could like to talk about it more than the time we have available.
Okay, great. So we don't want to hear the gong. So let's move on. The work that we're going to be hearing about today is being spearheaded by Francis Villablanca at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department, and he's been working closely with the graduate student, Katie Gordon, who has been heading up and doing the field collection and running the pelagic bird trips here in Estero Bay. She would present this, but she's actually in Alaska presenting this talk at a...
Does that work?
Yep.
That works. Okay, good. Thank you. My name is Francis Villablanca. I'm a biology professor at Cal Poly. And I've been working with Katie Gordon. She's a graduate student, and she has been collecting the data and organizing this 70s flashback. And these are preliminary data.
Pull down on that side one.
Thanks. These are preliminary data, and just like Dean was commenting, these are preliminary in the sense that these are our current analyses and our current opinions, and those are subject to modification. Katie's actually at the Seabird Conference up in Alaska, and one of the reasons we go to conferences is to present our ideas and get feedback, and oftentimes correct. So I'm with him. I won't really stand by it until other people have told me that they think we're on track, which actually is the way that science tends to work. Otherwise, it's really sort of our current opinion. Okay, I think I figured this out. The objective of our study was to look at seabird community changes, comparing a historic survey, which was done from 1975 through 1980 by California Department of Fish and Game, to a current survey, which was conducted in 2005. Actually, I have 12 months worth of data. The fundamental questions was whether there were changes in diversity, bird diversity. We're going to look at diversity and evenness. Those are sort of two ways of looking at diversity. And then also whether there are changes in abundance between bird species. We also wanted to see if there was if the seabird community was different between the historic surveys and the current surveys. If there was a difference, we wanted to try and determine what could be causing those differences or associated with those differences. And this association is actually an area where we really look for feedback from the scientific community, because people can think of factors that, for example, we're not currently thinking about. Some of the factors that we are thinking about is seasonality. For example, we know that many of these birds are migratory and that that should have an effect. We're interested in abiotic factors such as temperature, salinity, those sorts of things. We're interested in biotic factors, and those factors would include productivity, as might be measured by chlorophyll concentrations, and also fish biomass, schooling fish abundance, and those sorts of land-based data. I won't talk about that in very much depth. I'll just tell you what the result is, and you'll see why I'm not going to talk about it. This is a study area. It's basically Estero Bay, and we have
The little one?
Yep. This little blue guy?
Yep.
Thank you. We start here at Morro Bay, and we run these transects. There's 7 transects. The endpoints are fixed by GPS, so we know that we're basically traversing the same area. Then we also have these 6 land-based survey points. And the idea is that we can compare the data from the transect to the land-based data to determine whether we're seeing the same thing near shore, and then also compare these land-based data to the ship data to see whether we can actually figure out what's offshore or what is pelagic. Basically, the methods for the ship is we've got bird count and identification. We have a 200-meter radius. So if you think of here's the boat, there's a 200-meter radius coming off the boat, and the whole area in front of the boat is what we're surveying. So we're actually doing 180 degrees or a half a pi search. And what we do is we split this pi into this half a pi into quarters. We have one observer looking at this quarter. We have a second observer looking in this quarter. We have one person recording, meaning they're just getting calls, you know. However many birds, you just write them down. So you don't assist actually in the observation or in the detection of birds. And we have one person that we call the expert consultant. And that person helps us identify things that the observers might not be perfect at identifying. And I'll tell you, Brad Schramm is phenomenal. He's the most outstanding expert consultant I've ever worked with. The boat travels at 10 knots, so we have a time and area constrained search. That's really important because that means that we have constant effort. That literally means that we can compare one transect to another or one area to another. So as the boat, this thing's really sensitive. So as the boat moves along, basically we're running a transect and we're counting all the birds that we encounter in that half a pi. That's it. The bird count and identification from the land survey, we're using binoculars for detection. And the idea there is we've got a 200-meter transect that runs out from the edge of the water out 200 meters. We use binoculars to detect birds. And because we're actually on bluffs in some cases, we could be 300 meters or 350 meters away from the birds themselves. So we tend to use a spotting scope in order to identify. So we've got detection and then an identification phase. This is different. It's a little bit more time-consuming. So what we've done is actually focus just on a quarter of the pi, and we search that quarter of the pi for 5 minutes. Okay. Again, this is a time and area constrained search, which means that we can compare the points to each other. There's one observer and one recorder. We also take some environmental parameters that are on shore. There's several factors that we would like to test in order to determine if they contribute to variation in diversity or abundance. There's, of course, this one, the historic versus current. Is there any change between 75 to 80 and 2005? We hope that we can pick up a season effect because we know that these birds are migratory. That's kind of an internal check. We want to see if viewing conditions might be a problem. If we do find any differences between the past and today, we'd like to see if there are any environmental parameters, either biotic or abiotic, that help us understand or explain those differences. We're doing a contrast between inner and outer boat transects, and that will help us understand whether a shore-based or a land-based survey really is telling us about what's going on in the outer transect, or whether those are really two different things, two different data sets. And as I mentioned before, we want to be very cognizant of sources of error. Sources of error in a statistical sense are any source of variation that you did not include or control for. Okay, so this is like the rest of the real world. The approach that we're using is a multivariate analysis of variance. The idea there is that you take all of these parameters or conditions and you try and partition the variation. So you say, if there's a difference in abundance or diversity, how much of that is due to this, how much to this, how much to this, and so on. And one of the things that we can do is determine which of these variables, if any, significantly correlate with changes in abundance or diversity. So generally speaking, and species level really is looking at all of the birds within the species that we would ascribe them to and counting them within the species. There's a problem in that some cases we have unidentified species groups, for example, unknown gull or unknown tern, okay? And that actually correlates with viewing conditions to some degree. So we have a species level analysis, and then we basically were forced to deal with this because the historical data have a lot of species group identifications. So we just had to do that. We also have a combined group analysis. And here what we've done is we've grouped the species into the type of bird. For example, all the loons are together, all the alcids, all the gulls. And this really reflects or tends to reflect feeding strategies or guilds. So birds within a group will tend to do the same thing in terms of their foraging and life histories. Okay, so we want to look at diversity, species level diversity. There's lots of different ways to do this. And so what we've tried to do is come up with sort of a pluralistic approach. We want to look at things from a few different ways and see if we get different pictures. We're using, I don't know, is everybody really used to seeing a lot of math?
You know, I think just given your time,
yeah.
It would be great if you could go to your conclusions and you can backfill
great.
If people have methodological questions.
Thank you. I'll do that. Okay, here we go. Some results. What we can show is that if we look at the species, these factors that have asterisks next to them are significant. Okay, so if we look at historical versus current, yes, there is a significant difference in diversity. And so there are some factors that show a significant difference in diversity. Season was kind of our control, and nicely that actually shows significant. Viewing conditions, unfortunately, shows a significance in diversity. Okay, inner and outer transects likewise show a difference in diversity. So this is telling us something about our data and how we can come to some interpretation of it. Initially, we wanted to just do this, but that's a complicating factor, that's a complicating factor, and that's a complicating factor. And we need to know those things so that we're not led astray in terms of conclusions. This is great. Okay, so what is the relationship? Basically, here's the bottom line right here. As evenness increases, diversity decreases. So even diversity. So there's some kind of trade-off going on in the bird community. I should say that actually given these variables of diversity and evenness, we can actually explain 100% of the variation. So we have a really good handle on this data set. Okay, so conclusion, there is a significant difference between the historic and the current communities. The historic community was more even in terms of abundance between species, but less diverse. And the current community is less even, so there's more skew or bias between species, but more diverse. Okay. Well, you might say, well, the historic sample, they saw more species than you've seen. Yes, but for any one trip, we see more species than they saw. Okay. So possible explanations. One possible explanation is that the community has actually really changed. Another possible explanation is sources of error. And one of the sources of errors that we're concerned with is that Like I mentioned earlier, the 75 to 80 data contains a lot of individuals in these unidentified groups, unidentified gull. Okay? Well, unidentified gull might be one of six different species of gull. So if we can identify them, then our diversity goes up, because instead of having them all in unidentified gull, we actually have them in six different species. So that's possibly a problem. That's great. Group abundance. If we look at abundance of birds and not just diversity, we have exactly the same result. All of these variables are significant, so we think that there's also been a change in the abundance of birds out in Estero Bay. Okay, so conclusion, significant difference in abundance. And we're spending some time thinking about which groups are decreasing in abundance and which groups are increasing in abundance. We want to do that to try and understand what might be driving those differences in abundance. These birds have a different ecology and different feeding strategies than these birds, for example. So we're exploring possible causes for that. Future directions, we have funding, as you just heard, for two more years. So instead of doing a single year and having a snapshot of potentially an anomalous year, we should be able to time average a little bit. Also, we're trying to investigate. We haven't really had good fortune in terms of identifying data sets that we think are really representative of the Estero Bay, data sets that are associated in time with our boat surveys, and data sets that actually address schooling fish, which we think could be really driving the abundance and diversity of some of the birds that we've been studying. So this is an area that we don't really have a good handle on and may not have a good handle on. And the possibility exists that we'll come back in 3 years and say, we've got a really good handle on everything else except how the fish and the birds are correlating together. So I'm spending some time trying to figure this out and seeing if we can preempt coming back here and having to make that conclusion. Okay? And I'll stop there.
So we've got about 8 minutes or so for questions on this particular segment, questions that people would like to ask from the working committee or from others. Want to go ahead, PJ?
I just finished reading an article that was talking about...
Sorry about that. I just finished reading an article that was dealing more with insects, and it was talking about how over a period of time they had noticed that these insects had just basically graduated going further north and further north as the temperature changes were causing them to get to a habitat that they could survive in, and that the temperature changes were creating this northward migration because they didn't survive their breeding and laying. Have you been able to tell if any of the difference in the diversity of the species is due to the animals moving further north, further south?
Most of these birds are migratory, and so they're passing through. Many of the counts that we have are literally birds that we see for a snapshot of the year, 2-3 months as they move south, maybe 2-3 months as they move north, or even shorter. So we don't think that we're at an extreme in the range where the extreme would actually be moving north or moving south or doing anything like that, because the birds are just flying by. There are some birds that are resident or some birds that winter here, but really the majority of them are not. They're moving through. So it's possible that, and this kind of gets into the whole, you know, other factors and other possible explanations, it's possible that some of the species ranges are being modified. And so abundance or densities are being modified over space, and that's certainly possible. It still, from our perspective, would look like a trend, and really seem to be dropping out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other comment, Dan?
I had two questions / comments. One, sort of similar to what PJ was saying. I know last spring there was a lot of publicity about really poor nesting success of seabirds in California and in the whole Northwest. And so just interested, well, I guess in one sense it's a good thing that we've got funding to keep doing this, because it'd be interesting to see if that is reflected in the data over a couple years and whether we know anything about sort of larger region-wide nesting success during the 70s when the earlier data was collected. And then the other was as far as the fish data you were talking about, which I think does seem like it'd be really interesting to try and correlate with it. I guess in addition to searching for data, I'd encourage you guys to think about coming back to this group and through the EBM or other opportunities and, you know, it trying to start, you know, if we can't find that data from the past, we may be able to start collecting it now, and this would be a great group to think about how to do that so that, you know, we may not have the baseline from before, but if we can get that baseline information now, when we do the survey again in 20 years, we'll have that.
Yeah, so two comments. One is we think that our data are reflecting regional trends. So the alcids, for example, are thought to have had really bad reproduction this last year. And that's one of the groups that's really fallen out in our data. So, yeah, we think that we're seeing regional stuff. And I would like to be able to come back to this group with confidence and say these data do not exist. Therefore, we need to seek to generate them themselves. I would hate to ask for this group to help us generate those data and then come back in 3 years and say, oops, you know, look, they were already there. So that's why we're actually spending a lot of time trying to debug that.
Jeremiah?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious where the study area seems to be very small, and these are pelagic species. And I just came up from Los Angeles with the boat and traveled in, like 30 to 50, 60 fathoms on the way up. And there seemed to be a huge amount of bait fish from Point Arguello all the way up the line. Now, so when you're studying a small area like this, can you get a good idea of what's going on if the bait fish are...
Exactly right. So we need to, and that goes back to what Dan said, we need to understand what's going on regionally. So if we think we see a drop in one species, then the first thing we would do is check and see, is that a regional drop? Is that a local drop? What's going on? And our hope is that actually what we think we're really doing is we have one more sample from the ocean. Okay, so I don't think that we'll be able to tie in and say this is what's going on in Estero Bay and why. If for no other reason, because we've got currents, we've got fish that are moving through, and we've got birds that are moving through. So we're taking like this little film or these little snapshots of this whole process out there. But what we're hoping we're doing is that we're getting enough information for this area that we can tie into the other information that's out there and see if this area is any different from other places.
Is it a logistical problem to expand the study to an area that...
Yeah.
Well, it seems like with a pelagic species, that's something have to do.
It's easier to expand the study by collaborating and by reading the literature than by trying to collect more data. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of space out there, and you could spend a lot of time looking.
Yeah. Henry?
Thank you, Francis. You mentioned Brad Schramm early in the presentation. Brad's going to be speaking on Monday night at Laguna Middle School at 7 o'clock. And we don't have a brass gong, so we'll be able to... he's talking about vagrants. He's known vagrants that have come through San Luis Obispo County along the coast. Vagrants I've known and loved. So it's open to the public. Laguna Middle School at 7 o'clock.
Okay. Other comments or questions about this study? Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. First of all, to thank Francis. And Francis is going to be continuing to head the work up from Cal Poly's end over the next couple years. And I also want to take this time to thank Marla, who is the person who had the idea to start this study, and want to also mention that this is work that is being done with the Audubon Society. We're working very closely with them in this process. We're working with Patriot Sport Fishing. They're providing the boat service. I mean, they're getting paid for it, but they are providing it, and they're giving us a break on the cost. And we also get to involve a lot of the citizen scientists.
We do, and how we're doing it.
Marla?
I just had one comment. Thank you so much for a peek at the study while remaining cautionary on the
conclusions. And what, when you say 2 years, where did that start? How will that, how, what does that mean? Where's the end point of the study?
September to September.
So it's the, it got so funded the pa- this she, past September of 04.
Yeah, Katie okay. did 204 through 205. So we're in about month five of year two. Okay.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Greg Haas from Congressman Kapp's office. You have a comment?
Just a question.
Now is it on? Mm-hmm. I knew he was going to yell at me if I didn't take care of that first, so, because he does it every time. Just a quick question. You mentioned about collaborative efforts. What collaborative efforts are going on right now around, along the coastline?
In regards to this research?
Yes.
There's a lot, actually, and it's hard to summarize everything that you want to talk about when he's got the gong over there.
Yeah. Just but, a quick, are there?
Yeah,
there
yeah,
are?
Yeah, yeah, there are. So, for example, we've got collaboration with Morro Coast Audubon Society. They have come out. They've supported us financially. They've supported us in terms of generating interest, getting people to come out and do the work. We're collaborating with natural historians and ornithologists in the community. They're actually collecting the data.
I think I didn't ask the question right.
Yeah, go for it.
What other locations are we doing? And this, I'm reflecting what I think Jeremiah was getting to. Are there other locations near? I mean, are we doing this down in Santa Barbara? Are we doing this up in Monterey?
Every location we can find where they're collecting comparable data.
And are there a lot of those, or
there's? It depends on what scale you want to do. There's like a dozen groups doing surveys from Alaska down to Baja. So yeah, we've got a pretty good idea. Like Point Reyes Bird Observatory.
Right.
There's
the National the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary has got a beachcomber program that does pelagic bird surveys on several beaches along the entire Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And they're doing things like finding Brandt's cormorants die-offs and brown pelican die-offs. And so that kind of data is being collected, and it's shared through SIMON, which is the integrated network.
Where I'm also getting at, though, is are there research projects like this being conducted like this, meaning the combination of land and sea?
Back to this group and say, look, if you want to do this study, you don't need to spend that much money. You don't need to go out to sea on a boat. You can actually do it from shore. We didn't think that that was going to work because some of these birds are pelagic. They don't come near shore. But if we have those data, then we can say, look, this is the proportion of the community that you will get. This is a proportion of the community that you won't get. And that's a local thing. That's something that we're doing that other folks aren't doing.
I see.
But there's, I think actually the nearest area where this sort of work is being done is down by Vandenberg. So we've got some neighbors. I didn't know.
That's the end of my question. Thank you.
Thank you. No, it's just such a rich topic. Now, if people want to follow up and ask you more questions than we have time for this evening, what's a good way to connect with the team?
Best way to connect would be by email.
Okay.
Would you like me to give you that?
That would be great. Let me write what it is. Or you just, why don't you just write it up
I'll
there?
Just write it. Actually, I'll give you a phone number, too, if you don't
good.
Love email. And you don't have to call me professor or doctor. You can just call me Francis. That works.
Okay. Good. Well, thank you. Sorry that we are time and
That's
effort
fine.
Constrained. Appreciate your presentation.
Okay. Moving on. the next update that we're going to hear about is the work that we've been doing with the commercial fishermen on the Cabazon trap fishery project. And so this is a collaboration with Cal Poly, started in the Marine Interest Group, and the trap fishermen out of Morro Bay. So the person presenting today is Carlos Morales. He is a undergraduate student at Cal Poly, and he has been the person who's been forging these relationships with the commercial fishermen, and he's been doing the data collection and analysis with his advisor, Royden Nakamura.
Thanks, Ian. Okay, yeah, my name is Carlos Morales, and he recaptures, which is right at about 22% recapture rate, which is pretty high in regards to marine studies, tagging studies. Some of our objectives and goals were to determine the extent of site fidelity and movement of cabazon, to obtain high-resolution fishery and catch statistics based on standardized methodologies, such as catch per unit effort and growth estimates, to obtain estimates of abundance of cabazon in the sample area, specific to the South Central Coast. I'm not going to be presenting on population estimates today. We presented on that last April and just don't have enough time. And another main objective for this research was to foster cooperation and collaboration between the independent scientists and members of the fishing community. And the last is to provide resource managers with relevant data for decision making. So some of the specific topics of interest that I'm going to touch on today are first site fidelity, which is the affinity of a fish to want to remain in an area or to return to the area. And I'm going to present that by showing the actual distances between the initial capture locations and where these fish were recaptured. I'm going to be presenting home range estimates, which basically represent the area used by these fish in their daily foraging and their daily foraging and spawning activities, which gives us an idea of the actual area used by these fish, kind of like their neighborhood size. Homing behavior is the ability of these fish to return to the area once translocated or artificially moved to a new area. And this is also a measure of site fidelity. It's the willingness of a fish or the want to actually return to these areas from where they're initially removed. Growth estimates. We're looking at growth estimates in regards to the recapture lengths, comparable to the actual initial lengths of these fish when they were first captured. Okay, so first off, I'm going to pull up that chart. Oh, okay. Sorry. So I'm going to start off by talking about site fidelity. You can see here that we have a sample size of 180 fish. We have we only have six fish that were actually recaptured greater than 1,000 meters distance between capture events. So this data is critical and actually supporting our population estimates because we know that these fish really are not moving from where they're at. So to have strong population estimates, you have to assume that these fish are not moving, emigrating or immigrating into the area. So these fish really aren't moving within our sample area. And if they are moving, we're not seeing it. Home range estimates here. This is an example of this right here is an example of a home range estimate for a tag 303. In order to do the home range estimates for conventional tagging studies, you have to use a process called a minimum convex polygon method, and where you take the actual recapture locations and you draw a polygon around the area, and using GIS computer applications, we were able to determine the actual area, this area within this polygon, and which is an estimate of home range. So we had actually 16 fish that had at least three capture events, which are required to actually obtain a home range estimate. So for our home range estimates range from 151 meters square meters to 3,524 square meters. And the median home area for all of our home range estimates was 654 square meters. This is about just a little under the size of about a quarter of a football field, to kind of put into perspective. The length of fish was not found to influence the actual home range size. This home range estimates is extremely important in actually trying to understand where these fish are moving on a daily basis, and it's going to it's also going to help our population estimates and understanding of movement. So next, I'm going to talk about homing behavior of these fish. Since our last presentation, we've recaptured 5 more translocated fish. We initially translocated 41 fish to new areas. You can see here the blue and green circles represent the initial locations of captures. And we relocated the blue circles here to this triangle here and the green to here. And the X's actually represent the recapture locations for these fish. So you can see that all 10 of our fish have returned right back to where they were at. And we have a 25% recapture rate for our translocated. The distance relocated and the distance that these fish returned. Like I said, this is the furthest distance relocated, which is about 3 miles here. And the proximity distance is the actual distance from the X's to the circles, from the initial to the recapture locations. So you can see here that these are all within actually 166 meters of where they were initially caught, with the median proximity distance of 42.5 meters, about 139 feet. And something that we just actually found out last night going over this was that the median distance for these translocated fish is indistinguishable from the actual proximity distance of fish that were not relocated. Whereas, if you remember the first graph that I showed, the median proximity distance was 45 feet from their initial location of capture. For translocated fish, it's 42.5 meters. So it's if we just recaptured these fish and not known that they were translocated, we wouldn't have been able to have seen that. So there's about between 40 and 45 meters is the distance that we're thinking that we're going to be seeing these fish from when they're initially caught most often. Something else I wanted to point out is that tag 1021 is the fish that has experienced the most days at liberty after being translocated. It was almost at large for a year, 328 days. After being caught, it was within 36 meters of its initial location of capture. So not only are these fish returning, but they're staying, which is pretty incredible. So now I'm going to talk to you about growth. These are the recapture lengths for our sublegal size fish, our female fish, and our male. Right down here is the dot plot frequency. This abrupt kind of a stop right here is when the fish actually become legal size, and that's when I'm obtain the fish and I'm able to actually determine the sex of these fish. So that's why it just stops right there. You can see here that the average lengths for females and males are there's a large difference actually between those. From previous literature, we do know that females do grow to longer lengths than males, and our data does support that. You can see that the maximum obtainable size that we have from our recaptures is about 43 centimeters, and for females, it's all the way up to about 50. Limit the larger fish from entering these traps. And the traps also have, I believe it's a 2-inch mesh grid on them, so the smaller fish are able to swim out. So these estimates are for fish that range in the size from, say, about 10 inches to about 21 inches. So just something we have to keep in mind. So for our, so according to this data, our females are growing an average of 0.10 millimeters per day, and males are growing an average of 0.04 millimeters per day. So then if we just take this and stretch it out to figure out how long it would take for these fish to grow an inch, it would take 254 days for a female to grow 1 inch and 554 days for a male to grow 1 inch. And from previous literature, we do know that males are slower growing. Our data is supporting what has previous researchers have found. So we took our recapture lengths and our initial capture lengths and put them into a von Bertalanffy program for males and females. And just to note, I didn't picked these colors here for pink for female and blue for male. It's just the way the program works. But as we can see here, pink line represents the females, and the X's actually represent the oldest known age for females here, which is 18, and for males, 15 years. The males, from our research, when we actually took known data that is from Charles O'Connell that he conducted in 1953 on the actual age and size of Cabazon, so we used that in the program along with our recent recaptures, and this is our predicted growth curve that we received. As you can see, females living to a longer age and growing much faster than males. So some of our conclusions are that Cabazon display high degrees of site fidelity, with most recaptures occurring within 100 meters of their initial location, with the median of 45 meters. Home range estimates are 654 meters squared. The area is less than a quarter of a football field. And homing ability was displayed by all translocated fish, with the median proximity distance that is basically in population estimates and catch per unit effort. And it's some of our data has already been sent up to Washington University, to Jason Cope, who's in charge of the Cabazon stock assessments. Some of our future research that we like to conduct are to utilize acoustic tagging systems to fully examine the daily movement patterns of these fish, to expand translocation studies to greater distances and to northern locations, and to replicate these studies over the next 2 years for comparative analysis of population estimates and catch statistics, as well as for the monitoring of tagged fish currently at large. We have fish now that are just being returned that have been at large for a little over a year and a half now, so it's going to be, once we put these fish into analysis, it's going to be really interesting to see what they've been doing since they've been out there for so long. Some of the acknowledgments I'd like to make are to, especially to the Tom Hafer and Roger Colin, the fishermen who allowed us to use their vessels and their fishing equipment, to Pam and Jimbo at Bayshore's Fish Company for helping with the collection and storage of all our recaptures. Without them, I wouldn't be getting any of my fish back. I really don't. They're in daily contact with the fishermen, and they've been really supportive. And to all the commercial fishermen that have provided tagged fish and information during the study. At Cal Poly, I'd like to thank Aaron Nakata, Steve Reinke, and Daniel Castle for all of their help and technical support, for Dr. John Stevens and Dr. Andrew Schaffner, who provided help on statistical analysis, to David Yoon, who provided advice on all aspects of the GIS analysis, which was a lot of work, and to Dr. Dean Wendt and Dr. Roy Nakamura for all their support and advice throughout all aspects of this research. And Lieutenant Mark T. Crossland for help with the public awareness program, to the California Coastal Marine and Marine Initiative Resource Legacy Fund, who provided the funding for this research, and especially the support of the Marine Interest Group, who supported the pilot study of this research and is really adding to not only the basic biology of this fish, but to how this fish is going to be managed in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. And he came right in on time, so we have 10 minutes for questions.
He's an undergraduate. I have control.
Sorry, I was kind of racing the clock. But
Carolyn?
The size is right at about 38 centimeters for both. It's about 38 centimeters is right about 15 inches. And for females, it really starts off at about 15, but at 16, it spikes.
Jeremiah? Were able to determine any spawning patterns? Did they spawn at particular times of year, or do they spawn all year, or do they have a pattern?
Since I examined the actual gonads of all the species that were returned to me, the spawning really peaks. It starts in October and goes through March, with the peak in January. But there has been, in summer of last year, we did see some they might be actually reproducing twice in a year, which is I'm not sure, though. I would have to do some actual analysis on the ovaries and the testes. It is thought, though, that sometimes they might reproduce twice in that spawning period between October and March.
Yes, PJ.
The site fidelity and the homing ability of these fish, has that been noticed in any other study before, or is that something that, that came about due to what you guys did with this study?
On similar species of this fish, some of the intertidal sculpin, which are like Clinocottis analis is the, I think the woolly sculpin, has been, they've like translocate these like 4 or 5 inch fish 3 or 4 miles down to another tide pool and they come back. So they're similar species in the same family, but I've only found one account of homing in Cabazon, but it's not published. It's just, it was a tagging study done up north in Fort Bragg, and they had, I think, one fish return. But this is the first kind of in-depth study that's actually looked at translocation.
Congratulations on all your work. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
As far as the homing and the translocation, it seems like the location of the trap placement would be a really key factor in this. Like, if you kept coming back and putting your trap in the same spot over and over, then that would influence your conclusions about how far they're traveling and how big their home range is. Did you guys try and account for that or think about that? I don't know if I'm making sense or not. It seems like, you know, if you had a...
And we're just using the GPS coordinates to actually determine...
So you do have all the coordinates of where the fish were caught and...
That's what... In our initial tagging effort, we have GPS coordinates for all fish. For our actual fish that we have returned to them, we don't always get the GPS coordinates back, which is kind of tough. But we have GPS coordinates for probably about 200 fish now. So that's out of our 270 recaptures. So that's it's really helpful when we get all the information, but we don't always get it.
Bruce Gibson? If you want to step to a microphone, they appreciate that.
Oh, I think I have it.
So a major production for a simple question, which was what kind of accuracy do you have on the GPS measurements? I mean, if you were thought to be on the same spot, how accurate are you there?
Well, I believe that the actual units we're using are, they say that they're accurate to within 9 feet. But then I've seen some of the other units, some of the older units, they say that they're accurate to within 20 feet. It's going to be kind of hard to standardize that error between each of these, because I really don't know what GPS coordinates a lot of these guys are running. And if,
And these are GPS coordinates reported by the fishermen.
And we do have some, we did have some recaptures. We had 30 recaptures during our actual tagging effort. So those have also been used in this analysis.
John Rowley?
And when these fish are recaptured, they're not recaptured by the same fishermen that maybe answered Dan's question there. They're different fishermen catching the fish at different times. So the trap location would not necessarily be the same over and over again. Yeah. So it just happened to be that one fisherman caught it there and probably another fisherman came back there and set his trap later and recaptured that same fish. So it's getting pretty good because it's being caught over and over at the same spot by different people.
Yeah, our sub-legal size fish that are not being retained are actually giving us the kind of a better look at the movement of these fish because, you know, they're out there for more periods of time. They're just getting thrown back overboard and other fishermen pick them up, which is great because they just keep bringing us more data and the fishermen get money for their... information that they give to us.
It
goes into the actual looking at the actual like the biomass estimates of certain areas, and they look at the actual the way that these fish are moving and the strength of the biomass estimates. So they put like a whole package together of all the basic biology of this fish. But a lot of this movement stuff is not known about Cabazon. So it's kind of new. I'm sorry, did that answer your question? Roland might be able to.
Somewhat.
When they resurface up from that.
When we were asked to share some of our information in our conversations, I know one of the things that was emphasized was the fact that in a lot of these assessments that they make, a lot of it is relying on mathematical models, et cetera. And what they're really looking for and what our study provides are some of these other kinds of information that's sort of, what shall I say, not so esoteric, but right there, you know, right out from the area that we're getting it. It's site-specific, and it's pretty robust data. It's reproducible, as opposed to other kinds of information they're used to using. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but that was one of the things that they cited when they said, send us some of the stuff you guys got. We'd like to see it.
I mean, Don, I'll just, my understanding is that these parameters like how fast they grow, how far they move, they're all important in the models that the stock assessors use. They're parameters that they need in order to generate, well, how much fish can we take out? How sustainable is the population? They are using each of these parameters. So the better information we have about the parameters that they have to enter into their model, which include things like growth and movement, the better estimates they have for the biomass in this area and how much biomass you can remove based on how quickly they grow and how long it takes them to get to reproductive maturity and so on and so forth.
Well, I know one of the questions that this group has heard from various people is, you know, are the fishing stocks healthier here than elsewhere, and how far do these fish move, and what is their range, and therefore, is it appropriate to manage a fishery over a wide extent or more narrowly? And does this information help?
Yeah, I would say at least that's what our data suggest. And so that changes the way that you manage this fishery.
Okay. Final question? Rick, did you have something?
Yeah, fantastic work. And my understanding is that this basically was information that was not known. So it's really tremendous to see you doing this kind of stuff, and Francis's work is great too, but it's wonderful to see an undergrad making a great presentation like that. Maybe it's a question for Dean or Royden, but so what's the outlook for continuing this and potentially even moving into other nearshore species, resident nearshores, or like lingcod that move out and in?
Well, the potential for continuing it is, again, we got 2 more years of funding, and so we are going to continue to increase the size of the data sets over the next 2 years, and then we're going to start to get to comparative data, which is important. Like, you know, we don't know how CPUE changes because we've only done it 1 year, and so we've got no reference point. And we're also looking to, and I was in conversations yesterday with people in the Monterey area who are collaborating with commercial fishermen on the trap fishery to expand this project to a Central Coast-wide study where we're now going to try to cover areas from Monterey to Point Conception with people like Rick Starr at Sea Grant and Mark Carr at UC. We haven't talked about all of them, which ones we're going to look at, but it's going to be the near shore. We're going to be looking at different. We've talked about, this is a proposal stage, so this is just to address your question. This is not done for sure. But focusing in on the nearshore assemblage, using different methodologies for catching fish to try to compare methodologies, and I imagine we will use data for, I mean, look at species that we get, you know, but we're going to focus in the nearshore area.
Looks like there's some more, maybe just a couple quick comments, and then we need to go on to the next section. John, did you have something brief?
Yes. When Dean just made a statement there, he says on the other ones, the other fish, he said we have funding for another 2 year study. Speaking on the party boat, the commercial party vessel research that's been done in the past, we do have reference points, and if we're going to get if this could program at a known spot when we could use five hooks, and they know the size of the fish and everything else. I would like to see any more money and stuff put into studies that we revisit known places in the past so we can compare that. We're comparing today's data with data that the Fish and Game took in the past. And all I keep hearing is we have no good data, you know, the best available data. Well, we're not going after the best available data. Dean and his group are doing a really good job. I mean, I see the kids out there on the boat, and it's great, but I would like to see it go back and actually mean more than it could mean if we revisited the known reference points.
Do you have a quick comment, Dean?
Yeah, just that is exactly what, I mean, the best comparative data we have is the data that we have on the from the fishing vessels, the passenger fishing vessels. And so we have gone through and made all comparisons that we could make with what we've collected in 2004, and 2005. And we've got money for two more years, so we're going to have a total of 5 years of data, and we are comparing those data to everything that we can get our hands on, including the Fish and Game data and other sources.
But the Fish and Game won't let us go to those areas that we went to.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
They won't let
So there are particular areas that we can't access any longer. Yeah, well, that's up to them. I mean, we apply for those permits, and they make the decision about whether or not we can go there.
But if that data is available, we should be using that. That would be the best available data.
I agree.
Okay. So, Carlos, if people have questions, how can they reach you? Could you write that up for us? That'd
Don,
be great.
Can I just have one more question that's pretty important, okay. Very brief? Thank you. Carlos, I was just curious, because stock assessments are so important to the fishing community, and many of us have thought that some of their assessments were not completely correct, I was just wondering how the assessors make their assessments if, as you said, these particular fishing method exclude the large and the small fish. So how would one make an assessment, a comprehensive assessment on an area with the exclusion?
The other port in the state of California. So, gosh, I'm really not sure how they would account for that. I think when they actually do the assessment, they put it into a commercial catch portion of the actual assessment, and I'm not sure exactly how they do. Royden, do you? I'm not sure, Jeremiah, exactly how they would do that.
Well, usually when we give out this data, in fact, I've emphasized so many times that we have to point out the limitations to what we're sampling within the population at large. However, there are ways that they can sort of get around this. For example, like one of the growth curves that he put up there, if you're putting in a model, like he used a von Bertalanffy growth model, it's projecting the growth curve, a lot of times you may not have the data that fits the entire size range. However, the model is set up so that it can extrapolate, you know, within reasonable levels of confidence, the actual shape of the curve. So while we may not get all the data points for the entire size, we can get enough data that we can, as I say, use that model to make a reasonable assessment. There's going to be a lot of time. You can't get all the data. And so, you know, that's the best we can do is give them this stuff, but it won't include, you know, the larger size. We've talked about that, removing the exclusion devices, but then we'd have to face the wrath of the Fish and Wildlife Service if we had an otter show up in one of those traps, and that wasn't going to fly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the good research here. So this is one prong of the Marine Interest Group's activities, which is the whole effort of collaborative research. The other prong we're going to talk about next is the Ecosystem-Based Management Program, which is a very exciting program that this Marine Interest Group, along with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, has been involved with and creating. And there's really been a broad base of funding for this through the proposals that were prepared with the benefit of advisors from the Marine Interest Group and others and the leadership that Dean Wendt provided. A little over $3 million has now been committed to this. I don't know if you're going to be covering that in the sources. Okay, let me just do that briefly. $1.5 million from the Packard Foundation, something over $700,000 from the Cal Poly Foundation, $500,000 from the California Ocean Protection Council. This is a couple key things from the work of this group. One, how can we get better understanding of the health of the ecosystem? And two, how can we bring together these resource managers and the stakeholders and have a more robust dialogue and better coordination of activities? And those are the two key things that this effort is doing, and Dean's going to share information about that. We've got about 20 minutes for him to lay that out to you. Many of you have been asking for some more information, so he prepared this blue handout that you can take with you. That'll also become available on the website so that people can find that if you're watching from home. And then we're going to have about 20 minutes of discussion because people have lots of questions and interest in how this is going to work and what we can do with this. Dean.
Is there time for this?
There's time.
Okay. Well, I'll try to do it expeditiously, but also somewhat thoroughly so that I can give you an accurate idea of at least the beginning of what's going to happen. So as Don mentioned, we have funding to move forward with this project, which is being funded by a variety of sources, and it is a model, a regional model for developing marine ecosystem-based management. It's focusing primarily on Morro Bay and the Morro Bay estuary and Estero Bay. And it connects, as Don said, both with the Marine Interest Group and the work that the science that we're doing along the entire coast and also with the work that the estuary program is doing up into the watershed. So you all know Morro Bay is really a tapestry of uses in that you have the towns of Morro Bay and Los Osos, and you have fish and game and fish and wildlife, and it's an active port. You have a lot of different uses happening in this ecosystem, ranchers and farmers within the watershed. You have a prison in the watershed. I mean, it's a very, very active area, and this is an effort to try to bring all of those groups together and manage this area for all of the variety of uses that happen, and including, of course, the human uses. And the best way to approach this is through using a systems approach. And what we've developed is a series of program goals, and these were developed by the advisory committee, which I'll talk about who's on that advisory committee, personal experiences, the people who live and work in the ecosystem, and to draw on knowledge in the broader sense of everybody who lives there has knowledge of this ecosystem and can help facilitate management. So we're going to do this through an integrated program of scientific stakeholder and management communities. We're bringing all of these people together and trying to integrate them across the natural boundaries of the ecosystem, which includes the watershed, the estuary, and the open coast. So one of the first things that we did was develop a conceptual model for the ecosystem, which includes three components. And this is a systems way of looking at this ecosystem. So we have the watershed, the estuary, and the coastal ocean. And naturally, these components are connected by things like species movement in and out of the estuary and watershed into the coastal ocean, and of course also by input of water between exchanging of tides and freshwater input that we either get from groundwater or from the streams. And something that's important here is that we try as well to encompass within this ecosystem the fact that this ecosystem is providing things that we call ecosystem services and products. And so those are things like fish, clean water, the ability to go and look at birds if you want to go look at birds. These are all services that this ecosystem provides. And the healthier that it is, the better that those services will be. we end up being users of these services. So humans are here. We're a natural part of this ecosystem. And so our model tries to incorporate those users. And naturally, there's no way around it. You create stresses on ecosystems. We all do. It's impossible not to. Sea otters create stresses on ecosystems. So stress is not necessarily a bad word, but it's what we do. And the regulators are there to affect those stressors to try to manage and make the ecosystem sustainable and sustainably deliver these products. What this does for us, though, is it tells us conceptually who needs to be at the table. Who needs to be there? We need scientists there, we need the users there, and we need the regulators there. And it also gives us the ability to look at how things and come up with critical questions about the ecosystem, like nursery environment. And so, and I'll get into a little more detail with some more detailed diagrams using this approach in just a moment. So we came up with five initiative areas, and these initiative areas were defined by the advisory committee, which includes the resource managers, includes the stakeholders and scientists. And so there are representatives from the MIG, representatives from the estuary program that all sit on this advisory committee. And we wanted to make sure that we were focusing in the right area when we developed this program. And so we had them tell us what's important to them. And then from that, we designed ways to address these questions. So the initiative areas are water quality, biological indicators, socioeconomic indicators, critical spawning and nursery areas for nearshore fish and invertebrate species, sustainability of human access, that is, how much human access can we have and sustain within the ecosystem, and then very importantly, linking science to resource management and ecosystem health. That is, we generate data that is useful to managers and scientists, and that hopefully, since we designed it in this way, when we have data, it will affect change within the resource agencies. Okay, so they will make decisions based on what we're doing, and hopefully it's relevant to them in that way. I don't have time to go through all of these, but I want to take a couple of them and highlight some of the science that we're actually going to be doing and bringing to bear on some of these questions. So first, the water quality. We want to determine the spatial and temporal changes in the physical and chemical characteristics of water quality in the Morro Bay ecosystem. And so how are we going to approach that? What techniques are we going to use? So that's the first one I want to talk about. So here's an example of that diagram expanded to take a look at water quality. So you have freshwater input, which is going to be influenced by a rain event that might occur in the watershed. And let's say we're interested in what's driving the production in the nutrients within the bay and estuary. Where are the nutrients coming from that are going to allow eelgrass to grow and allow the fish species that are using it for a nursery environment to grow and thrive? Is that coming from nutrients that we find in the watershed, or is that coming from, let's say, nutrients that are coming from the coastal ocean and an upwelling event where nutrients are brought from the deep ocean up into the sunlit zone? So where is this coming from? Fish and the fish stocks rely on this basic cycle, and so it's important to understand what's happening at this level, ultimately to understand what's happening here at this level. And just to highlight a little bit, these symbols, S means that this changes in the same direction, and O means that it changes in the opposite direction. So if we have nutrient levels go up, primary production goes up, and then secondary production goes up. But when secondary production goes up, there's actually a feedback here, and primary production will change in the opposite direction and go down because the secondary production will feed on the primary production. So this is just a way to characterize and conceptualize the changes that might be occurring. And it gives us an idea of where we need to measure. What do we need to measure and what do we need to track to see how this system is interrelated and how these different events might ultimately lead to changes, for instance, in fish stocks. And so each of these little symbols here, these little triangles, is an area where we're going to be taking a measurement of some sort. Okay, so some sort of change. And with the water quality, what we're going to be doing to get an idea of the water quality and how that's changing over the ecosystem is we're going to be deploying a series of real-time arrays at each of these spots within the ecosystem. And these arrays are going to measure in real time things like changes in nitrates, that is the nutrients, dissolved oxygen, salinity, temperature, chlorophyll A, this is an indication of how much primary production is happening. And we even have a way to look at how much sediment is suspended in the water. And so these stations, and this is showing one that is designed for profiling a water column, ours are going to be much flatter so that we can stick them in places like here up in the at the creek mouths. What we're going to be able to do from this is look at things like nitrogen budgets. Where are the nutrients coming from in the bay? Are we getting most of the nutrients coming out here? Are they coming from in through the watershed? Is there some hidden component that might be coming from somewhere else that we can't fully characterize? But what these data will allow us to do is make these sorts of budgets, if you will, of where all of the nutrients are coming from. And what's really terrific about this high-resolution data is determine ultimately how the watershed affects the bay, how the open coast affects the bay, and identify where those sources and sinks are within the system for all of these separate parameters, and see how they change over an annual cycle and over several years, because this is a three-year, starting with a three-year effort. All right, so that's some idea of what we're going to be doing with the water quality monitoring. We're also going to be looking at bioindicators. So now we're stepping up from the physical and chemical. We're starting to look at the biological aspects of the system. And I should mention, actually, that this is being run, this is the director of this aspect is Dr. Mark Moline at Cal Poly, and he's the director of the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences there. This is Lars Tominek. He's also a professor at Cal Poly at the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences. And he is working on a project to develop relevant bioindicators. That is, can we use some of the organisms in the estuary to tell us what's happening in the estuary? How healthy is the estuary? Are we seeing nutrient stress? Are we seeing stress from physical things like salinity or temperature stress? And this is a really important point that was brought up by a lot of the people on the advisory committee, that we don't have a lot of great indicators of organismal and ecosystem health. And so Lars is going to be applying a very cutting-edge technology called proteomic analysis. And what this does is it's like taking a blood panel of a person. You go to the doctor, they draw your blood, and they look at the proteins in your blood, and it gives you an indication of how well your systems are functioning. If you have high levels of certain proteins, it's like, this person just had a heart attack. If you have, you know, there are normal levels and high levels of these proteins in your blood. And so in the same way, in an analogous way, Lars has a technique to look at the expression of proteins in organisms that live in the bay. And he, so this is, and this is all the, all I'm going to show you here, this thing that you're looking at thinking, what is that? This is actually a protein gel. And what it is so you take the organism, you grind up its tissue, and you can separate out the proteins. And each of these spots is an individual protein. And this is what's called an expression profile. And it changes environmental stresses. And so this is a very powerful tool because you can go out and sample an organism and say, here's how this organism is being stressed in the environment. We're seeing a response that looks like pollutant stress right now. We're seeing a response that looks like a low dissolved oxygen. And so the key to this, though, is having those profiles set up. You have to know what this different stress or the responses look like. And so that's a large part of his work, is to develop these appropriate indicators. And we're going to be looking at invertebrates and then also eelgrass as a potential indicator for these protein expression profiles. And so it's a very exciting area. It's very basic research, but it could have really big management impacts down the road if it works out. And we can use it like they do in medicine, where they take a blood profile and say, we know what's going wrong in your body because of the proteins that you're expressing and that we're finding in your blood. So it's the same analogous kind of situation. All right. So that's some of our efforts in bioindicators. So now we've moved up the food chain a little bit. So chemical and physical, and now bioindicators. We're also going to be looking at how important the bay is as a nursery habitat primarily for fish. And we're going to be doing this in a couple of different ways. One is we're going to be using some of the latest technology in bathymetry, using multi-beam bathymetry, like this image here that I stole from the project director's site, Dr. Rick Kvitek at CSU Monterey Bay. He and will probably be here next month, actually, doing these detailed bathymetry maps of Morro Bay, inside the bay, and then some areas outside of the bay. And what we want to be able to do is identify the bottom areas in very fine detail, like this. This is an area in Monterey where you can see terrific detail of the geology. And from this, you can predict where certain species are going to live, especially the fish species. And so we're going to do this inside the bay. And that's going to be happening very soon. At the same time, over the next 3 years, we're going to be doing comprehensive multi-gear sampling several times a year within the bay, all of the different habitats. So we want to see what lives there, what's actually there, the adults that are actually there, the different fish species. So if you have within their ear bones, what the chemistry of the ear bone is related to where the fish are living. And a nice thing about an otolith, as it's called, and this is actually, I should say, this is a brand new paper that I just received and I got my hands on using otoliths, the chemical composition of otoliths, to evaluate the nursery role of estuaries in English sole. So we're going to be doing an analogous thing, and this was just published in January of 2006, so it was just out. This is a picture of an otolith, and what you can see is that there are rings within this otolith. And so the fish is laying these down, these rings down, like tree rings, successively. And depending on where they are when that ring is laid down, it records a chemical signature of the environment. And so you can go back in time and say, where did this fish live based on the chemical composition of that otolith? And so this is the youngest part of the otolith. And you can dissect this out of an adult that lives out on the coast and then analyze the chemistry of it and determine if the chemistry is like that of an estuary, like in Morro Bay, or if it's like that of the open coast. And in this study, she found that approximately 50% of the adults on the open coast in the Monterey area actually developed as juveniles in the estuary. That's really important. If we can get numbers like that, you've got this little tiny estuary and this huge open coast. If half of the individuals are developing as juveniles in the estuary, that's really significant in how you view that estuary and the importance of that really small habitat to the open ocean and the coastal populations of those fish species. And so this is being headed up by John Stevens and Royden Nakamura at Cal Poly. And we're going to be focusing on the California halibut, because we know that they spend some time in the estuary, and we know that they're commercially important. And so we're going to focus our efforts there to start. And perhaps, who knows? I need to call her, actually. I just got this paper yesterday. So so this is a technique that has worked before, but it's, again, a very a relatively new technique, and I think it'll could give us some really interesting answers about the bay. Okay, so I didn't go into some of the other areas in the interest of time, and I'm surprised I haven't been gonged as yet, but this is Cal Poly, and this stakeholder group, okay? This is really the foundation of this program. We're building on the good work that these entities have done. But we're also capturing on our advisory committee although we have to talk a little bit about this, the relevant local government entities, things have changed there, as you know, recently. There was a turnover, but I haven't changed the slide yet. The federal agencies like NOAA and Pacific Fisheries Management Council, Fish and Game, State Parks, the Regional Water Quality Board, and the Coastal Commission. All these people were here and present in the planning of this whole process, and so they've been here since the inception. This is our organizational structure, and I think that we have a great opportunity to develop a regional model for ecosystem-based management that will, in fact, these are really experiments that are being run right now in several areas, and we got picked as a place to do this because of the success that we've had over the last couple of years with this group and with the estuary program over a longer amount of time. And so the information that we get from this, not only the science, but how we all work together and how much we affect change is going to be used in other areas in California, certainly in other areas in our country, and who knows, we'll go big, even the world. So you might as well think big and see where we get. So I guess okay. I've been gonged, and I'll take some questions.
Yeah. All right. So questions about this. I just comment, one brief comment before the questions, we get the lights, thank you. And that is that through the good work of the advisory committee and Dean and others that have been involved in this, this initiative is really putting Morro Bay and the greater Estero Bay area on the map. It's really prompting major research institutions in other parts of the country to say, wow, something really interesting is happening here, because as this group knows, the Pew Commission and the U.S. Commission on Oceans and others have all been talking about ecosystem-based management. How do you get a holistic view, get these agencies and stakeholders working together? And this is really, to our knowledge, the first instance of this happening on the entire West Coast. So a lot of interest coming to this, a lot of hopes about what this may bring, a lot of work yet to be done. And so welcome your questions and comments. Marla?
Dean, this is one of seven ecosystem-based management models developed by Packard. Can you tell us about where the other ones are?
So I don't know the total number. I was only aware of, and you may be able to correct me on this because I don't have a comprehensive understanding of their entire program. They have one in Fiji, one in the Gulf of, they are supporting vastly different efforts that are doing much different things than we're proposing. I know that.
But it puts it in a global context, which is pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah, I suppose it is a global, literally a global endeavor.
The other thing, I'd like to ask the MIG if we could come together with a thank you letter to the Packard Foundation, Cal Poly, the California Ocean Protection Council, Coastal Conservancy Resource Legacy Fund, and to the elected representatives, Congresswoman Capps, Senator Maldonado, and Assemblyman Blakeslee. And we used this template before for putting a letter out, and I'd like to just pass this out, make sure one gets down to Don. And if the MIG wants to use that kind of layout to send a thank you letter to those groups, I hope we'll get that done right away.
Okay, I would just suggest that the MIG might consider also expressing thanks to the other institutions that have helped get to this point, because it's certainly the work that the World Wildlife Fund and others supported in helping the MIG come together. And the interesting thing in all of this is how in each of these instances with the World Wildlife Fund, with the Packard Foundation, with others, is they've all taken the approach of a hands-off. That is, sort of let the stakeholders and the resource managers responsible for the area define the agenda. I think that's really been a very magnanimous effort on their part, and something that's really enabled this community to come together on what it wants to do to help improve these resources. So we might also consider sharing that letter with those other supporters. And I know that includes the Steelhead Coalition and others who have helped on collaborative research and other things along the way.
Well, thank you, Don. I mean, of course we thank Dean and Dan and you, Don, but it's a little harder to send a thank you letter to ourselves. But I just wanted to make sure that since this funding was just approved, and to our elected representatives particularly, that they get a something that looks kind of nice. And maybe it should be more. Maybe it should be more than a letter. Maybe we need to put something together that's a nice framed picture. I mean, this was a lot of effort and a lot of...
is really cutting edge, and it's just amazing. And I second what Marla said about saying thank you to the funding agencies and our elected representatives and the institutions that are providing support on this. Mm-hmm. But this is just, it's very exciting. And Dan Berman as well, this is something that I think is really going to help protect this our invaluable estuary. Thank you.
Pam?
So do we need to vote on this, Don?
Well, I think if it's been suggested there'd be a letter, I think maybe if a couple of you have a particular interest in that, I might work with a couple of the members in crafting a letter. We can then get it out on the email list, everybody, to see if others have comments and turn this around. And if people have creative ideas to respond to Marla's query about, you know, is there some way we could create a little special flavor about this recognition for those organizations? That would be nice, too.
I agree. And I want to thank Marla, too, for the stationery, because that really speaks to our collaborative efforts here. Mm-hmm. But I have one comment, and I know that the Los Osos CSD is the brunt of everybody's jokes nowadays, but unless they've withdrawn their support, I think that we should, you know, make sure that we have some respect for the efforts that they're going through to try and not make an impact on the estuary any more than it's already being impacted. So.
That's certainly the objective. I think the only reference here was just the advisory committee has not met since that election event, and so therefore there just hasn't been an opportunity to engage them, but that would be the plan.
Positive reinforcement.
When next will the advisory committee meet?
That's being scheduled. It's more than likely going to be the end of next month.
Thank you.
And I just want to acknowledge that the members of the Marine Interest Group that have participated in helping with this have been Bob Hather, Carolyn Moffitt, Dan Berman, Dean Wendt, Leslie Krinsk, and Rick Algert has also been helpful, as well as Jay Elder, who's often involved here in the activities with the MIG. So appreciate everyone's involvement in helping to make this happen. So we have other questions, comments, suggestions about this, or things that you'd like to...
men in science, and I think this is just going to be a whole new level of that that's going to empower this group and the estuary program to do more. I also want to emphasize, I think Dean said it already, but that Packard Foundation and RLFF and the Coastal Conservancy and Cal Poly and all the folks who funded this, I think there's no way that this would have happened if the Marine Interest Group wasn't in existence and making the kind of progress it's been making, or if the estuary program wasn't there. I think these folks looked at this area and they said, wow, there's a lot of the pieces of this concept of ecosystem-based management already here. We've got all these stakeholders working together. We've got some institutional structures that are bringing resource managers and stakeholders and scientists together. This looks like a really good investment to try and build on that, rather than in another area where you'd have to be starting from scratch and trying to create all this. I think we've got some of the hardest work is already done in terms of having these structures in place. I did try and tackle, I've been talking with Dean and Don and other folks and my own, the Estuary Program's Executive Committee, trying to understand, and I think it's just going to be an ongoing sort of adaptive management process, it's always a good word for these things, of kind of the institutional framework of how, you know, what this new organization or effort of the EBM, how is that really going to interact with the estuary program's existing structure and institutions and with the MIG? And one way, obviously, is with this advisory committee that has representatives from the MIG and from the estuary program. You know, and then, of course, this group is generating data and research, as we've been seeing, that is going to inform the efforts of the EBM scientists. And similarly, the asteroid program has a whole sort of history and library of research and work that's been done. And I, if I can pull out my notepad, I started to try and diagram the stuff, and I think it's going to be a work in progress, but I hope it's helpful. The easy one.
I think we just have a 2-minute riff on this.
Okay, less than that. I'm going to get going every morning. The easy one is the geography. The estuary program has typically been focused on the watershed and the bay, although we do, to some extent, talk about Estero Bay, but this is really where a lot of our work has been. The MIG is the whole coast of San Luis Obispo. EBM is looking at one of the questions is, you know, what's the interaction here? How is this really a stakeholders group, all of us, funding research, supporting collaboration, and just starting this, essentially, and trying to make sure that what we do, are both our opinions and the research we fund, feeds into resource managers. You know, the Asteroid Program, which has a pretty robust kind of institutional structure we have, and we are already within this smaller area, trying and successfully bringing agencies together with stakeholders, sort of in the same vein as the MIG, and this gets ugly, or complex at least.
I hope I don't have to start over now.
No.
Don says no, and then the question is now we have this EBM effort and the advisory committee, which consists of members of both of these groups, as well as a number of agencies, many of which are already interacting with the MIG and the NEP, and I think one of the ways we're going to measure the success of this is how much we can not duplicate our efforts, but really build on the existing efforts, which I think is the idea from the outset, and figure out how can we, you know, build the relationships here and build the tie-in with the resource agencies. And so this is going to be a work in progress to see how these different institutions can interact in a way that's positive for all of us. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. I would just say real quick, I know, Don, we got to go, but, I mean, it shouldn't be lost on people that Dan is part of the leadership team of the ecosystem-based management effort. And so, you know, there are some real people connections here in that Dan's intimately involved in all three of these. I'm intimately involved in them as well. Don is involved to a large degree, and the three of us are part of this leadership team with the ecosystem-based management effort. And so if Dan will put me on the Bay Foundation board, then we would be all together,
it's a monopoly.
But anyway, what I'm trying to emphasize is that we have, from the outset, even though we don't have a diagram yet that we can really show Marla that will satisfy her, we're going to get there, but that, you know, we've tried to build that integration through our leadership team, and so we're hopefully going to continue that and represent that well as...
Okay, so we have several more things to time in October. Dean indicates that he's not going to be, and his, all the researchers are not going to be generating a lot of new information before the end of April. So it's open for other topics that you might like to bring up. So I'd ask you to just take a moment or two while we're finishing up a couple other items on this agenda and think about, you know, what are things that you've been wanting to address and feel would be this would be an important forum to do that in, so that we can come up with our targeted topics for next time. While you're thinking about that, let me just run through a couple of things here. Dan, I know that Matt Fleming had a new arrival in their household of a baby, I think within, what, the last day or two?
Yesterday.
Wow. Valentine's Day? Okay. So that may have severely...
That's our baby's birthday.
that may have severely affected the degree to which the two of you had done some work with regard to the...
I wonder why I wasn't getting calls back.
The MIG organization subcommittee. But remember, that was a subcommittee to address the issue of, you know, how is members rotate, are they replaced, how do we handle a number of the sort of administrative and organizational side of things, and Dan and Matt are taking that on. Do you have any brief comment?
The update is, I think that we should revitalize the membership of this group. It was originally Nancy Dahlman and Matt and I. Nancy is across the country now. Matt sounds occupied. I've been so busy with this fabulous EBM proposal, among other things.
And twins Matt, of your own and since we...
twins that were also born on Valentine's Day and had their first birthday yesterday. I'm happy to continue to be on this. I'm sure Matt would be happy not to be at this point if his experience of the next 3 months is going to be anything like mine of the last year. So I think if we had maybe a couple other volunteers, and I think it's really an important task that we need to pin down. I mean, a simple part of it is sort of a MIG code of conduct, and that's pretty straightforward. You know, be nice, play nice with your neighbors. But the trickier part is going to be to try and sort of work towards bylaws. We've never really had bylaws per se, but at least document who are, you know, we haven't come across it this time, but we have in past meetings. What's the process for getting new members? Who are we all representing? You know, are people here representing, you know, their particular, you know, as their representatives of, does Burgess Landing have a seat, or is what is that seat representing? And there's sort of been a history.
Pam?
Between now and April, probably a couple meetings and exchanging correspondences and sort of kicking some drafts around. And I think what we'd come back with is a draft for the larger group to consider.
I nominate Tom Capon.
Okay. All right, so we'll have those three. And who's going to take the lead in inviting and pulling those folks together? Because I'd like to have one person, so at least I know whom to turn to for updates about this.
I nominate Marla.
Okay. Thank you, Marla. All right. Dan, do you have a quick 1-minute version of the restoration study?
I do. This is a project that I think will interest a lot of you, and some of you are probably aware of it, and some of you not. Let's see. The 1-minute version. Okay. The estuary is filling in with sediment. It's been happening very rapidly. Over the last 100 years, we've lost about a quarter to a third of the volume of the bay. It's one of the biggest challenges that the estuary program is working on. As the bay fills in, we're losing eelgrass habitat that's important for fish and halibut and flounder. And essentially, the bay, through a natural process, is going to gradually turn towards a salt marsh, but it's been happening really rapidly, mostly because of land use changes in the watershed. So there's a couple different things we can and have been doing. One is to work upstream to reduce the amount of sediment coming down through erosion control, restoring floodplains. That's stuff the estuary program has been very actively involved in and continues to be. The other approach what I'm trying to get to here is, can we and should we and is it desirable to do something in the bay itself to remove some of the sediment that's accumulated or to change circulation patterns so that sediment that as it comes in has a better chance of getting out of the bay? So we could be talking about either dredging, physically removing some of the sediment that's accumulated, or altering patterns, either where the creek comes in or the channels in the bay, to improve the circulation and the flushing of sediments out of the bay as they move through. This is a study that the estuary program engaged in with the Army Corps of Engineers, about 5 years ago. We've completed the first phase of the study, sort of what are the current conditions, what happens if we do nothing. The conclusion was if we do nothing and erosion continues apace, the bay is really difficult. You can't just go dump them offshore. Because they're really fine clays, you're not allowed to, you can't place them on the beach. Various government agencies are concerned, sort of treat them as their pollution. If we take them out to shore and dump them, they could kill marine life, smother the seafloor. So we have to take them potentially hundreds of miles away, which costs tens of millions of dollars. Other options that were exploring in more detail, that one's sort of on hold for the moment, include altering the path of Choro Creek as it flows through the salt marsh. It switched channels in the mid-90s. Now it flows out to the south. It deposits its sediment load onto a shallow part of the bay where it's accumulating rapidly. If we pushed it back into its channel that it was in before 1995, conceptually at least, it flows into one of the main channels that flushes the bay, and so we suspect that that would help move more sediment out of the bay. The Army Corps is working right now to try and do sort of the scientific side of it. Well, that sounds nice. Would it really work? And, you know, other options include some more smaller scale, limited dredging. There's areas of the sand spit that have really rapidly extended into the bay, burying eelgrass and other subtidal habitats. Some of those areas would be much easier to dredge because they're sand, and so it's much easier to just move it offshore in a nearby area. I just wanted to let folks know that we're in this process. We're evaluating these different alternatives right now. We expect actually in April to have some preliminary results of how effective would these things be. Obviously, each of them comes with sort of costs and benefits. There would be short-term environmental impacts associated with doing any of these things. We've been working throughout the process to hold public meetings, keep the community and stakeholders informed. That's why I'm talking to you about it here. It's been moving kind of slowly for the last couple of years, so we've been a little quiet on it, but we're really gaining speed right now. We'll probably be having a public meeting, and I can provide another update at our next MIG meeting, probably in May, I would guess, with some guess at how effective some of these options would be. And based on that, we'll be deciding how to proceed. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So let's move on here to, we have two of our MIG members on, that are present this evening that are on the, or have been on the regional stakeholders group, Jeremiah O'Brien.
Been modified. So that's tomorrow. You should be able to look on the website and look at the four or five proposals that are there. Then March 2nd, the science advisory team meets to evaluate those proposals again. And I'm not sure when the Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting
14th
is,
and 15th.
Okay, March 14th. That would be the next. How's that for 30 seconds?
That's good. Okay. Jeremiah, comments?
Pretty much because the proposals are being revised, and I am personally not aware exactly to what extent the fishing industry's proposal, sport and commercial, is being revised, and it is still a work in progress. There's not really much that I could say at this point.
Okay.
It's just in progress, and the progress is continuing. So,
all right. Thank you. John, did you have a...
Yeah, I guess I could address this to both of them. Is this the proposals that we're going to be able to see on there, is it going to be a product of the task force, or is it going to be a product of the science advisory team?
The last task force meeting asked the proponents of Proposal 1 to try to bring their proposal closer in alignment with the science advisory team recommendations at that time. And the task force also asked the proponents of Proposal 2 to bring their proposal in better alignment with socioeconomic impacts. So since they met a couple of weeks ago here in Morro Bay, that process has been ongoing, and I think we're all waiting to see what that looks like, which we should be able to do tomorrow.
What do you think?
It appears from my own personal perspective that the Blue Ribbon Task Force is being steered by the science advisory team. I think there's a great deal of they're leaning a great deal towards that that team agree with pressure being put on the fishing industries to alter our initial proposal. But again, it's a work in progress.
Okay. And Dean Wendt serves on the science advisory team, just to put him in the middle of yet something else. And that group has been working as volunteers, as have the participants in the regional stakeholders group, in spending many, many hours in trying to get the best perspectives from everyone's vantage point included in this process. So more to unfold about that, and more information for everyone to be learning about over the next couple of weeks. Janice Peters, as Mayor of Morro Bay, did you want to make a brief comment about the members of this group have had interest in the future of the Morro Bay Power Plant, realizes you have a process underway for that and other things that you've been doing? But if you might have just a brief update, I think people would be interested in.
Okay, very brief. We did form a committee, an ad hoc committee of 12 members of the community, not just Morro Bay residents, but from around the community. A lot of really interested and interesting people with varied backgrounds, and I think it's going to be a very good committee. It was formed before LS announced that they want to actually do the remodel, so I don't know what the ultimate result will be. We don't know if LS is going to get their permit, the water permit, to do the remodel. It's all still kind of up in the air, so the ad hoc committee's work will proceed, and should that not happen with LS, then we will have alternate plans all ready to go. So we're trying to be ready no matter which way the wind blows.
Okay, thank you. And Greg Haas from Congressman Capp's office, an update about the Bureau of Reclamation about toxic waste disposal. And I know P.J. Webb shared with us some information about that as well that I sent around to the members. But Greg, a brief update.
Thanks, Don. Not much more than what P.J. had found out earlier. I called the project manager and talked to him for a while about the project, where they're at, what's the next steps, and what can happen, and some possibilities. Of course,
the basic topic here is there's a substantial amount of selenium waste in the Central Valley that the Bureau of Reclamation is trying to figure out what to do with. It had evaluated a number of different options.
So that means that the Delta alternative and the ocean outfall alternative are not on the table. Now, they were in the draft and are part of the consideration. However, he has said that one of the in-valley alternatives, I believe there were three or four of them, and they last time I had talked to them, the Bureau of Reclamation, they were talking about some kind of mix or match and some different things like that. They're still looking at it. But he expected the EIS to be released in May or June. And that we'll know. Now, however, the caveat is, even though that the Bureau of Rec here is working on an in-valley alternative, I caution the group to be vigilant in following this process, because he did say that a higher level in the administration or even Congress could change that EIS. And that's always a potential possibility, but until we see the final EIS, we won't know. And hopefully in May and June, we'll see that they're leaving the coastline alone. But right now, that's what the Bureau of Rec is working on and what they're recommending. And
so is there any action that the Congresswoman is recommending local people who have a concern about this take now, or just wait till May or June?
I can't think of anything more than what the local people and folks and representatives and agencies and just about everybody living and working in San Luis Obispo County hasn't already said concerning this issue. We have elected representatives' comments from state on down to CSDs, to neighborhood groups, to everything about this, to individual farmers and ranchers that own land that they want to put a pipeline on. So, are there any more recommendations? He said that the comments were entered, were being reviewed, and I believe if you read between the lines, were being so noted, and that's one of the reasons why they're looking at the Ind Valley alternative. It's not the only reason, but it's definitely something that they've given weight to. And the pure weight of the comments from the folks here in the county was pretty dramatic.
Okay. Thank you. PJ, a real brief update on the sanctuary, and then I want to quickly capture ideas from the...
It may be very informative to everyone since we've all been dealing with the marine protected areas. This is going to be a symposium that it's free of charge. It takes place on March 4th at the California State University, Monterey Bay University in Seaside. I have some handouts here that will talk to you about what's going on. It's an all-day event, and it's going to have members of stakeholders groups. It's going to have a couple of case studies of marine sanctuary, marine protected areas, and community perspectives from fishermen, from ocean-based tourism, and religious community, divers, etc. I know that we've all learned a lot about the marine protected areas during the MLPA process, but this is another community information-only symposium that does not offer a particular point of view as to is it good, is it bad. It's another community discussion. So that could be very interesting. Something else that's going on is the January-February issue of Scuba Diving Magazine featured the top diving destinations, and the one that was listed as the healthiest marine environment was the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which is Morro Bay's neighbor to the north. So I think that's it's nice to see that ocean-based businesses are getting to have a nice light out there and some light shown on how beautiful our area really is. On a personal level, I want to really thank all the members of the MIG that I've seen. I've noticed their incredible hard work on the MLPA process. There's a tremendous number of stakeholders down here who were involved in that process, and it's been a really long, hard haul. But an awful lot of people in this room have put a lot of time in, and I personally want to thank them for doing that because I think it's going to make what comes out of that process that much better.
Oh, just on that note, I wanted to acknowledge that Rick Algert has served on the regional stakeholders group as well. He's an alternate on the marine interest group.
And that leads me right into a nice segue. I am putting together a Morro Bay Water Coastal Safety Kayaking Safe Wildlife Viewing Fair. how does that sound for trying to do? this is in response to some information that and complaints and reports about things that have been going on. A number of organizations have shown interest, and what I'd like to do today is just put the word out. I'm going to send around. If you're interested in being involved and being on the email list for this future fair, ocean fair, ocean enjoyment fair, whatever we're going to call it, please put your name down here, and I'd like to make that a part of you and your organization, a part of having a day to celebrate all the wonderful things you can do in Morro Bay and how to do them safely. I think that's about it for me. Oh, I have an action item that I would like to consider for our next meeting. I want to follow up on what John Rowley said about the possibility of pursuing the MIG writing a letter encouraging and supporting Department of Fish and Game to allow Dean Wendt to do some research in some of those areas that he was talking about, that John was talking about, that would really be a good replication of of studies they've done in the past.
I might have misstated myself a little bit there, too. What I meant to say was, like you said, we would like to have access to the areas that were done 15 years ago. Because what Dean's doing today, you can look back 15 years from now and see what's happened. We have the opportunity to look back within the next year to the past 15 years and see what's happened. I think that we really need to pursue that.
I would like to have, for us to possibly have a discussion on that and possibly come up with some way that we can, as the MIG, encourage and support Dean's access to some of these important, replicating these important historic studies.
Okay, so maybe one of the ways to help tee that up would be, Dean, if you and the research group might come up with sort of a menu of things would be possible and what would be some options, then the group could discuss, you know, the different trade-offs involved there and see if that could be of help to you. That would be one idea. What are some other ideas that people have about topics for future meetings? Dave.
I think we need to get into a little deeper discussion of the EBMP. I think the gong was hovering there a little too tight. So I would like to get into some more depth, some of the things that the dean moved through very quickly. I'd like to see a little more detail, a better presentation, a longer presentation of that in our, as a focus for our next meeting. So I'd like to hear a progress report on that.
Okay. Who else has topics or things they'd like to hear about? Pam?
I'd like to go a little bit further out in the county coastal area than just Morro Bay. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of sewage spills lately. We've had a lot of illness reports in the surfing community. So I think that maybe we should broaden our horizons a little bit and start looking at some of these other areas.
So broader coastal issues, and you're thinking about
water quality specifically.
Spills, water quality, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something that we would, you'd like to have somebody from the regional board that tracks those kinds of things to help give kind of an update of what's been happening and what's the status, as well as members of the MIG that have knowledge
right.
about that.
And I think environmental health at the county level, too, who does water quality testing. So that we have kind of an overview of who's testing, you know, what the parameters are. I know at the national level, they're trying to count beach closures if you're closed for 7 days as one closure rather than seven individual days. And I think that's misleading to the public. So thank you.
Okay. Who else has topics or things that would be of interest? Mel, why don't we start this way and go around?
There's actually been a great deal of work done, behind the scenes to try to use the work that Dean Wynn and Dr. John Stevens have been putting together in a report concerning this onboard survey to use it in the state and federal regulatory process to be of some benefit to regulations. And there's been a lot of work done. I would like to maybe give you an update of some of the work that's going on and what the potential is and what some of the big drawbacks are. We've really tried diligently to see if we could export this idea statewide, and I'd like to tell you what some of the roadblocks have been in this area.
Okay, so part of what I've heard about that is that you've been talking with Fish and Game about whether other California State universities might want to do collaborative research in other places on the coast, and you've got some information to share about that.
Great cooperation in some of those areas. There's a huge amount of data, same kind of data that we had for the Central Coast was gathered between 1988 and 1998 between San Simeon all the way to the Oregon border. From Point Conception to the Mexican border, there is near for quotas because they won't. They go from the Mexican border up to Mendocino, Point Mendocino up there. That's their deal, and that they won't divide it any smaller. The federal government won't. So we're trying to work with them. I'll explain all of this maybe in the next meeting. It's
okay.
Kind of complicated. What's happened is we're now light years ahead of everyone else in the state of California on data about the fishery off this coast. All the rest of the state is way, way behind us, but the point is we can't use this for our benefit. We can't find a way for either the state or federal government to agree to use what we've got to benefit. I mean, it's like we're doing all this work, gathering all this data, and everybody's saying, great, great, but they're not using it for any part of the regulatory process.
Okay. Other topics that are of interest to people. What I might, Rick, did you have something you wanted to ask or offer?
It would be a potential topic, and I guess I'd ask the MIG if I hate to be the bearer of bad news since there's a lot of good news here tonight, but in the harbors, Morro Bay is a good example of how we're losing all of our support businesses and infrastructure.
I'll second that. I was hoping that we would find a place to talk about that. Actually, I had intended to talk about that as I made my introductions. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Carol. And I would just, as example, the Marine Chandler is closing down, the Genies Marine Supply. The one sport fishing landing that's left is closed down with all their employees laid off, but I think one or two. They're hoped to open again on April 1. The Commercial Fishermen's Organization, who we leased the last operating fish dock to last year for $1 a year, had to cease operations and lay off their employees, seek emergency funding because they were losing money. They've now, I think, obtained it and hope to open up again next fishing season, but it's very, very difficult. Yesterday, I got a call from the operator of our last fuel dock. He is losing $5,000 a month and has to think about closing the last fuel dock. And this is typical of Port St. Louis, I think, traditional uses. And I think it even affects, my question is this of interest to the MIG? A lot of it's coming from outside forces much bigger than us. I think the city's doing everything it can. But
has been closed since October. It's extremely difficult to run a business when you are closed 8 months out of the year. And we're not sure what the status of his lease is going to be either. That reflects on to the boatyard. The boatyard concessionaire works on marine engines, and nobody's hauling out their boats. This is the socioeconomic impacts, and if a study were to be done now, it would be a post-mortem study.
Yeah, again, that's well put. I mean, we've identified a trend where we're at the very end of the trend. The line's about to disappear at zero.
That also affects recreation in this area too. On the overall, when you start taking away all the services, you start losing all the recreation availability to the valley and the other areas. It's not just here; it's going a long ways.
It affects the environment as well in Morro Bay. There's not really a functional haul-out facility. There's sort of a semi-functional one, but it's not. Not as good as we would like to see in terms of its, environmental practices. Just by its location, just not possible at the location it's at to really do things as well. And I know in Port St. Louis, they spend a lot of time and money on getting a haul out facility that really captures all the waste, some of which can be pretty toxic. And now, they're lacking the business to keep it going. And in Morro Bay, there isn't a real functional haul out facility, especially for bigger boats. It makes it hard to get derelict boats out of the bay. And it makes it hard for responsible boat owners to keep their boat ship shape in an environmentally friendly way. And so it has a direct impact on the environmental health as well. I think it would be a great topic to go into greater detail on. And I guess the question really is, what can the MIG do? And I think, Carolyn and Rick and fishermen especially, if you guys can come to us with, the more concrete suggestions you can come to the MIG with of what can we do as a group, and I think it really gets directly to Mel's comment too, that if the problem, what's the source of this, and if the source is really that fishermen here are being regulated based on landings and off of Oregon, then I think it just emphasizes Mel's point of how can we make sure that fisheries are managed based on local information here. Because that may be one of the few ways that we can try and change the situation.
Yeah, let's see.
And perhaps use that stock assessment model to present to the Department of Fish and Game, as the Department of Fish and Game is in control of everything within three miles, except for the Rock Cod Conservation Area, of course. And I did mention, probably Dean might not like this, but I did scold the Department of Fish and Game for what that was worth, for not permitting access to areas that they currently have closed, especially to state universities. I can't even comprehend But I said that what they should probably do is they don't have data, and they always say they don't have the money to obtain this data. And I said, well, if Dr. Wendt and Dr. Stevens and Dr. Nakamura wanted access to these areas, why didn't they send along a couple of their own people? Because you'll probably have to pay for that thing. And I said, you could, that way the department would get a study and the universities would get the study. So hopefully they'll see fit to do that in the future, but I can't comprehend them not letting you guys in there. It's just crazy.
Sure. Marla?
Following up on that, I'm very curious from an economic point of view, the pricing of fish, how do, like, farm-raised salmon affects the price of wild-caught salmon, and to what degree are our markets being affected by just the globalization? So part of the problem in the harbors sounds like what happened when Walmart comes to small family businesses, too. So what other aspects are involved here with regard to global prices of fish, where, how the markets changed out of our area that affected landings and the cost of doing business? Okay. For a small business person compared, but that's just on the harbor question. I did have some other topics to add.
Okay.
You might need to turn the page over to capture the meeting.
Yeah, because I do want to...
Where are we now, and how do we fit into it with what we're doing with the EBM study? I think we should definitely make a short amount of time available for a steering committee report on some of the topics that we come up with from that. And I know there's never enough time for more education, but the Bevan Sustainable Fisheries Seminar, I'd like to see where we might be able to fit that in. They've got some wonderful topics from Washington University, backing into the ecosystem, is NOAA getting it right, topics of bycatches of marine mammals, the invisible collapse of recreational fisheries, patterns, processes, and prognosis, property rights and ecosystem management, and Southern Blues, the challenge of managing by consensus. That has to do with the international tuna fishery, but what lessons are they learning that would be applicable for us to know about? And that might get back into auxiliary time. Mm-hmm. Outside of the MIG, that we could present some of those talks.
Okay. Well, you've got a robust set of ideas. Now, the question is sort of what do you have the capacity to get your arms around? So there's a couple ways of doing this, I think. One is, you know, you could take a shot, and we could have various ones of you that have an interest in these different topics sort of help prepare agenda materials and whatever else on these different topics and kind of do a sampler version at the next meeting where there might be, you know, 20 minutes on each of these topics. Or we could, you know, have each of you pick two of these that are you think are of the most relevance to the MIG and something that you feel the MIG could do the most about. And we could just narrow it down to, you know, a couple topics and go to some greater depths. Which of the two approaches do people have more of a preference for? How many of you would prefer to have kind of a sampler version across these different topics? One, two. Was sampler, that means a little bit of about each of these versus just pick two and go into them in more depth. So a couple of you would like to do the sampler version, that is to sort of get multiple things out. Does that mean the rest of you would prefer to pick a couple and focus? How many of you want, just so I'm sure that you're still awake and with me here, the rest of you are for a comparison. How many of you feel that would be a...
That can be combined, actually, with the subject I was talking about.
So you'd like to, okay.
I know a lot about that subject there.
So combining those two. So in other words, what's being done with the collaborative studies, How can they be more robust, and how can they make a bigger impact on the regulatory environment? Is that sort of the topic? All right. How many of you feel that that would be one that would be useful for this group to discuss? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. How many of you would like to have a further deep dive on the ecosystem-based management program? 1, 2. Dean, you're off. You're off the hook. How about how many of you would like to have a discussion about broader coastal issues, water quality, and perspectives from the regional board and environmental health from the county, et cetera? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. And how many about the harbors, the socioeconomics, what's going on with all that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. And how about the Sand Crab Collaborative? Dean, is there much of a story there to even share? Maybe I think that might be one of those 5-minute updates.
That
right?
goes with the coastal issues. That was meant to be for.
Oh, okay. That could go over into the water. Okay. The Joint Ocean Action Report from the Pew Commission and the U.S. Commission, and what's going on there. You know, Marla, we could have a show of hands. How many of you want to do a deep dive into that in some way? 1, 2. Do you want to come back with like a maybe just a 5-minute update about that one? Is a way to handle that. And the Bevan Sustainable Fisheries thing, I guess we just need to know there were last time we had a couple hours of showing of the videos that you brought back from that conference. And I guess the issue would be, you know, that does involve some time, resources, and expense with AGP video and so on to do that. How many of you would like to have a forum where that can be done? It wouldn't be in our regular meeting because that's a lot of time, but it would be.
Time with that, but maybe there's an opportunity over the next year to have some kind of like a special global educational lessons learned that we could gain from. And
so that might go over to sort of a. Something that you could check in whether Cal Poly would like to be a forum for that? Okay. So it looks to me like there's really two things here that had a lot of attention. The access to areas from historical studies and the use of the scientific data and what can be done with that. And then the issue about the harbors and the socioeconomics. Do you want to take on two things or three next time?
Three.
Okay, so what I need really from you is who would be a couple of people who would be willing to kind of work on this? Dean, on this access to areas, you know.
I thought I got out of this. I thought that was Mel.
Well, I think we need you to help identify what those are historically that you'd like to have access to and what the prioritization of those might be. And maybe Mel.
Yeah, I believe that I could, and I'll look into it. Gary Stacey is the head of the marine region for the state of California now, and he's very interested in this issue. He's very aware of what the problems are, and I might be able to get him to come here.
Mm-hmm.
He lives way up north, but he might be willing to come down here. We've worked with him within the last 2 weeks trying to see if there's a way to use this data in the regulatory process, and he wants to do it, and he knows what all the hurdles are, and there are some big hurdles.
Well, what I'd like to suggest here is that, you know, like three people work on each of these topics, help prepare some things, identify some people who can come and talk or get the relevant information. I'll connect with you to make sure we're kind of pulling it all together. So that might be Mel. Dean, I think, you know, you need to help out on identifying data sets. Yeah, is there a third person to help?
Try and get them to give us the data and give us the permits to do the stuff. I'll take it up with Deb Wilson.
Okay.
Don, I just have a really important point about this, that if we're going to look at historical data that we consider not just going back 15 years, but also to historical accounts, anecdotal, you know, information, and...
And Henry, who else? Anyone else? Dan, thank you. Now, what I need for each of these is, let me get the last one down here, the harbors, socioeconomics part of this. There's also a socioeconomics part to the ecosystem-based management program, so there'll be an opportunity actually to bring some resources to this that might be helpful. Who'd like to work on that effort? Carolyn?
I think Rick volunteered also.
PJ as well.
Rick? PJ? Okay. Is there anyone else?
I'll volunteer for Jim if you
do. You'll volunteer for Jim?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the things I'd like to maybe explore in that is kind of check out and do some research and see how other harbors have handled these sorts of situations. I mean, we know it's bad, but what kinds of positive alternatives and options might there be?
It's very helpful to look for examples elsewhere, because otherwise it's, you can really get focused on our own. Okay, now what I need for groups is who's going to be a lead person? In other words, by that, it doesn't mean you have to work any harder than anyone else, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be the point of contact with me about this, and be sure that the group, you know, does its job in pulling together, you know, a fruitful discussion. So for this first one here, the first one we discussed, the collaborative research and the use of the scientific data, et cetera, who's going to be, who'd be willing to be kind of a point person for that? Mel, you're willing to do that? Okay. On the water quality issue, who'd be willing to be the point person?
Ebony and I are going to share that.
We're going to create our own website.
We'll give you one point.
Ebony and Ivory.
But I need one person right now. Then you can...
I'll do it.
You'll do it. Okay. All right. And then on the last one, who would be willing to do that? The Harbors of Socioeconomics. Carolyn, Rick,
Jim.
PJ, or Jim? Yeah, right. Doesn't mean you have to do more work than somebody else, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be a point of accountability for me.
I don't e-communicate well. Otherwise, I would be glad to do that.
I'll go. I can do that.
Okay.
PJ,
yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Now,
thank you, PJ.
Next meeting time. End of April, early May. Which do you prefer?
Early May. April.
April?